about you. And so we want to think deeply about God. We want to think deeply about the things of God. We don't want to be satisfied with the stock answers to life's most important questions. And so we hope that you've come here to think with us this evening. We want our faith not to be blind or a leap, but we want it to be well-reasoned and thought out. And so we host events just like this so we can continue thinking through our faith. So if you're here tonight and you are a follower of Christ, we're glad that you're here. And we hope tonight that you're challenged. We hope tonight that you're strengthened. And we hope tonight that you are equipped to think about the Christian worldview in a deeper way. If you're here tonight and you're not a follower of Christ, we are glad that you are here. And we hope that you too are challenged in your thinking. We hope you see that Christianity is not opposed to deep thinking. It's not opposed to science. But in fact, Christianity gives us the very fuel and coherence for thinking deeply. And so as we walk through tonight, we hope that's exactly what you'll see. You received a program on the way in. Just let me make a couple of notes there for you. First, there's a couple of recommended resources for you. So our hope is this discussion continues beyond tonight, that it continues to go forward. And so there's two books and an article, God's Undertaker, Has Science Buried God? By John Lennox. It's just a book that is engaging modern science and its relation to an atheistic worldview and a theistic worldview. There's another book that was recently published called Did Adam and Eve Really Exist? Who They Were and Why You Should Care by Jack Collins. And again, this is examining the historicity and the relevancy of a literal historical Adam and Eve. And then third is a paper that I just recently came across, a PCA Study Committee report on creation. And it's a good primer. It's going to give you a lot of definitions about terms that you may not be familiar with, so you can go and find it online. And it's important to note, not everything in those books express the direct beliefs of Restoration Church, but we do want to provide those for you to think through. Also, tonight is going to be an interactive night, and so we don't want to just bring you here and tell you without hearing from you. And so in a minute, we'll introduce our speaker, and he will speak for about 45 minutes or so. And then we're going to have an open forum of question and answer. And you can either do that live, so we'll take hands and we'll ask, or if you have a question that comes up in the middle of the talk, you can text it right in, and through the Q&A at the time, we'll read those text questions as well. So you can either ask it live, or you can text those questions in, and we'll get those as well. And also, for those that are texting in, know that your phone number is completely private. We do not see it. We don't know where it's coming from. We don't have access to it. So feel free to text and know that we won't have your phone number. A couple of more notes. One, this will be recorded. So if you're asking a question, just know that it'll be recorded. We'll put it on Restoration Church's blog. There's several people that couldn't attend that are interested in hearing this dialogue. And last but not least, if you are looking for a restroom at some course in the evening, if you go down these stairs right here, you'll see signs. Basically, the men's restroom is right below these stairs, and the women's, you have to walk kind of back through that way downstairs. So you'll see signs posted for us. So we are thankful that you're here. We're looking forward to this evening. I'm going to bring up Nathan Knight, the other pastor of Restoration Church, and he's going to introduce our speaker for us this evening.
Once again, allow me to welcome you as well. So glad that you're here, took the time to come and to just think through this issue. Do want to mention that we've done these things from time to time, and they tend to go really well. Our desire here is to serve, and so we hope that is a good tenor for the conversation, that this is not any time to pick fights or things of that nature, but we can have a good civilized discussion and just think through things. So glad that you're here, and again, we're sponsored by Restoration Church. We meet here on Sundays at 5 p.m., same place. We meet inside there on Sundays at 5 o'clock. I hope that you'll come and join us. Our speaker tonight is Dr. Bruce Little. He is an author and professor of philosophy, the president of the Forum of Christian Thought. Dr. Little travels the world, just recently got back from Romania, where he spent some time speaking and interacting with people there. Dr. Little has written quite a number of books, which I won't list them all, but one of his most recent is God, Why This Evil, whereby he discusses the problem of evil in the world, so to speak. So we're glad that he is here, and he will speak to us for a time, and at the conclusion of his lecture, we will then field those questions. So why don't you join me in welcoming Dr. Little.
Well, thank you. I notice that people clap when I come and they clap when I leave, so I'm not really sure what I'm supposed to make of all of that, but I'm delighted to be here with you this evening. Last week at this time, I was debating an atheist in Pennsylvania at a college campus, so maybe things will go easier for me here than they went okay there. We want to talk about naturalism. Some of you may know, have read the poems of T.S. Eliot. One of my favorite poems is his poem, The Rock. And I'll just give you one stanza. He says, "Where is the life we have lost in living? Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? And where is the knowledge we have lost in information? The cycles of heaven in 20 centuries bring us farther from God and nearer to the dust." What I will do tonight is make some introductory remarks. They're not going to be arguments because I don't have time to make an argument. What I'll be doing is simply making some claims. And then during the Q&A time, that's when you push back on the claim. That's when I will try to give you a defense of the claim. But if you're just thinking, that's not much of an argument, I just want you to know up front, I'm not trying to make an argument at this point. I'm making some claims. Well, after I've done that, then you'll have an opportunity to ask questions. I want to begin tonight with a quote from maybe an unlikely source for you, but it is Richard Dawkins' book, the one that he wrote in 2009, and the title of it was The Greatest Show on Earth, and possibly you have read the book. Now, on the first page of the second chapter, Dawkins raises an interesting question. He asks this question: why did it take so long for Darwin to come on the scene? And after suggesting possible answers, he approvingly quotes from the late Ernest Mayr, who was a great biologist, and his suspicion was that the most insightful answer to the question was this: the culprit, Mayr says, was the ancient philosophical doctrine of, well, to give it its modern name, essentialism. The discovery of evolution was held back, Mayr says, by the dead hand of Plato. Now, the first part of the lecture is maybe a little deeper than the last part. But we need to understand something which is a little difficult to begin, because it's not a discussion that's being readily heard today, at least in the public square. And I talk to college students, university students, and they look rather blank when I raise these questions. Now, what do we mean, or what did Mayr mean, by essentialism? And the idea is simply this: you don't have to buy into everything of Plato to accept essentialism. So I will try to make it clear as I can. Essentialism simply teaches that we are what we are, not by developmental issues, but by our essence. That is, we all share something in common tonight, and that is we all share in the essence. You can use the word nature, but that might get confusing since we're talking about naturalism. So let me stay with the word essence. All of us share in the essence of humanness. That's what makes us all the same in one way. And yet we have differences. That is, some of us are tall, some of us are short, some of us are female, some of us are male, and so forth and so on. And most of us, I think, have all of our limbs, but I will only take myself. If you cut both of my arms off, I would still be a human being. Because arms are not what make me a human being. You can cut my legs off, I don't recommend it, but you could do that. And you could cut my ears off. And now it's getting kind of difficult. But if you do all of that to me, I'm still a human being. Because I'm a human being by virtue of my essence. And we can talk about maybe in the Q&A where the essences come from. I think from a Christian point of view, they come from the mind of God. That would have been Augustine's point of view. In his writings, we see that. So there is each of us share the same essence. All living things have their particular essence. So what makes a horse is, of course, the horse has the essence of horseness. And so I think that will help us. Now, there's the essence, and then there is what we call particulars. The essence is a universal. The contingent part of creation, that is my body, that is what in me, I'm a particular. So what happens and what has happened is if all we have to talk about are particulars, that is you as a particular and me as a particular, and our relationships to one another, I think what I hope that I could suggest to you and make it somewhat convincing that this whole notion of only focusing on the particular is what has really put much of the Western world in a great difficulty in trying to work some of the great problems we have sociologically, but more about that later. So we have the universals, that would be the essence. We have the particulars, that's the individual person. Now, when this started, and it doesn't start with Bacon, but Bacon was very much interested in not just the developmental issues of the physical, but he was also very concerned about the essence. He was a theist. I don't know if he was a Christian, but he was a theist. As time went on, and as the whole notion of that which transcends experience began to be drained out of the thinking of the Western world, that then left us with only particulars. And out of this, as Mayer says, and Richard Dawkins thinks he's right, and I actually think Dawkins is right as well, that naturalism needed to get the dead hand of Plato or essentialism out of the way. Why? Well, because if you and I are human beings by virtue of our essence, then you could see it would have been impossible for us to come about by way of evolution. That's the point that Dawkins is making. That as long as you think that I am what I am by my essence, and my essence is a universal, then I couldn't develop into something. I am something, and then I have these physical manifestations of it. And Dawkins says that's right. We really have to get this whole matter of essences out of the picture. Anything that transcends experience must be out of the picture. And he said, when it is, then evolution was enabled to go. Now, I'm not here to talk about evolution. I'm only using that because that's the very thing that Richard Dawkins brings up. So I would define naturalism as a denial of anything that transcends experience. Richard Weaver, in his book, Ideas Have Consequences, when he was writing in 1948, says that the denial of universals carries with it the denial of everything that transcends experience. By universals, we're talking about essence, maybe not only that, but at least that. And the denial of everything transcending experience means inevitably the denial of truth. With a denial of objective truth, there is no escape from relativism of man, the measure of all things. So what would be the implications if you and I are left with only the particulars? That if I was to understand myself and I am to understand you as only a particular, how would that, what would that say about how I related to you? Would I relate to you differently than if I believed that you were a human being, that you had the essence of human being? From a Christian point of view, I would say that you're made in the image of God. What difference would that make in how I treat you? Well, I think, at least theoretically, I don't think theoretically, I'm saying I think, at least in a theoretical way, that it would make a lot of difference. And I would try to point out, or I will point out, whether it's convincing or not, that I think this has a lot to do with how we view beginning of life issues, end of life issues, how we treat the human being, how we viewed things such as equal rights and matters of that nature. If there are only particulars and there's no such thing as a universal, no such thing as an essence, I am what I am developmentally. All there is the natural. All there is matter. All there is the biological, chemical makeup of Bruce. He's nothing more than that. That doesn't mean he might not be special. I remember of lecturing to a group of doctors at a convention, bioethics convention, a few years ago, and we were discussing this very issue. And there was a doctor who really wanted to debate with me about this matter of essence. And I said then, what significance do you give to the fetus? And he said, well, it's a very special thing. But I said, but why is it special if it does not have, it is not what it is by virtue of its essence, rather than simply its DNA makeup, why would it be special? And he really could not answer that question. He was a fertility doctor, and I might realize why he was concerned about that. So when we're left with just particulars, we have to get significance by our relationship one to the other. But think about how difficult that is, and think how troubling that becomes. What if my significance is determined only by my relationship to you? If you no longer want to have a relationship to me, what happens to my significance? And we find that this is really an issue sociologically. For people who are looking for other particulars to give them their sense of worth and significance. Now, I'm not suggesting that my relationship to you and your relationship to others and all of that, I'm not saying that's not important, because I really think it is. And I also think that we actually do derive a sense of worth, et cetera, by our relationships to one another. However, what I would argue is that can't be the foundation of our understanding of humanity. So if there is only this relationship of one particular to another, the changes then, if that's all we have, then how do we assign meaning, significance, etc.? It seems to me it has to be borrowed from another worldview system, and I really think it often is. It seems hard for me, and I would love to have the discussion, it seems hard for me to avoid the conclusion that, one, if all we have are particulars and there is no such thing as a universal, there are no such things as essences, then I would think it's hard to escape exactly what Richard Weaver says, that we eventually come down to a relativism, relativism with regards to truth, relativism regards to morality, simply because there is nothing above us that stands over us. Each person becomes, as postmodernity would have had us believe, each person becomes his own truth declarer, his own integration of all reality by which he determines what is truth. So that's one thing. I'm not sure how we avoid the relativism of truth and the relativism of morality. It's very interesting. I've been debating some atheists, and the atheist I debated last weekend actually said, I believe that there are universal, moral, objective, moral standards for everybody. And I said, wait a minute, am I getting this right? Are you telling me that there are some things that are always wrong, always have been wrong, always will be wrong for everybody everywhere? He said, absolutely. And I said, and you are an atheist? He said, yes, I am. So now you're telling me then, one who believes there's nothing above nature, but now you're telling me that there are these universal moral, what they would say, principles. Now, he's not the only one who believes this. Wallace and Armstrong would say the same thing as Mark Hauser would apply, Edward O. Wilson, James Q. Wilson, who recently passed away. All of these would affirm the same thing. Now, here's the problem that we have. First of all, particularly since 9/11, nobody wants to be a moral relativist anymore. It's just not in, it doesn't seem to be in vogue. So you've got to figure out, how can you be a non-moral relativist and still be an atheist, in which you're claiming all there is the natural world? So now, when I debated Wallace and Armstrong, he said the exact same thing as the man that I debated this past weekend. He just says moral laws are on the very same order as mathematics. They were there long before man evolved. Well, man evolving just simply came to know them. He came to understand them. And so my question has been, and my question has been twofold. Number one, okay, if they're there and all there is the natural world, where did they come from? For which I've not received an answer. Number two, if they are really there, these abstract principles, which Mark Hauser calls them, that everybody has, if they are principles that are up there, don't worry about how they got there, where they came from. The question is, if they're up there, how do they get in the constitution of the individual particular person? For which there is no answer, because that's exactly the same problem that Plato had. Plato could not figure out how could you get the form in the individual. And so along comes Aristotle, and Aristotle says, well, the forms aren't really up there, the forms are in here. And so he thought that solved the problem. But for those who argue that there are universal moral objective principles applicable to everybody, everywhere, all times, even if we don't try to push them on where did they come from, they've still got to answer the question, how do these principles up there get inside the individual? So as he said, they all claim we are born with these. They are innate in us. So I think that's a question that has to be answered if all we have is the natural world. And I hear those things being said a lot in and out of public discourse, though I don't hear many people talking at that level. A third thing that I think that follows from naturalism, and I'm saying I'm making a claim, you can determine whether I have any merit in making the claim or not. By the way, just as a parenthesis, I'm a critical realist. I think that we go for the best explanation from inference. And I don't think I don't know why we negate the thinking. I don't think this, I don't think that. I think we should really say, I think that, and then negate what we think, rather than saying, I don't think. Seems to me I don't want to get into that mode, okay? I was in that for too long a time. You know, I tell my students that I graduated in high school second from my class. But I said, it wasn't a very big class. There were only about 100 of us. But I said, and they said, oh, well, that's still pretty good, you know? And I said, well, I mean to tell you, I was second from the bottom. And that's the truth. I was second from the bottom and didn't go to the college until the first time I walked on the university campus, I was 34 years old. So I got a real late start on things and met. And they say, that figures why the guy's so crazy. He's got to start it late in life. The other thing that I would think is going to happen here, if all we have is naturalism, if all we have is nature, and everything is determined, everything is situated and defended or defined as in terms of biological, chemical, causal action, how do we avoid either one, a totally deterministic world? If everything is related causally, in some kind of biological chemical chain, how would that not then be lead to a deterministic world? The other option you would have, and I'm really not sure how that would look or how you could explain it, but the only other option I think we could have would be that it's a chaotic world. I think you'd have those two choices. It's either a very deterministic world, that is, or it's a very chaotic world. I'll come back to the deterministic world in a minute. If it is a deterministic world, I think I'm going to leave the chaotic world out. I think it's theoretically a possibility in naturalism. I think the more likely candidate here is a totally deterministic world. And yet, if we live in a totally deterministic world, it seems that there's a lot left to explain. That is, the fact that we believe, that is, as human beings, we believe we are causal agents. We believe in what is called the principle of alternative possibilities. As we think that we really do have choices in life, and we think those choices really do make a difference. That is, I think that if I chose to climb the ladder, that if I would have not chosen to climb the ladder, that the events would be totally different than if I had chosen to climb the ladder. We really think we are causal agents. Well, if we live in a deterministic world, in which some people think we do, and in fact, Richard Dawkins does, though he would not want to state it so boldly as that, how is it that I explain the fact that I wrestle over making decisions? If I don't really have any power to choose, if I'm not a causal agent, then it would seem to me I wouldn't wrestle with anything. Furthermore, how do we explain the fact of human language? Human language, and I am told by linguists, I'm not one, I am told by linguists that all known languages have the mode of possibility. That is, should, if. We use them all the time. We say, I ought to have done that. If I would have done that, things would have been different. Well, I suggest that if we lived in a naturalistic world, those words would not be in our vocabulary. Let me explain it like this. Suppose you lived in flatland, all right? Flatland is only a two-dimensional world. It has no, let's just make it simple, it has no height, okay? Now, there may be more dimensions than that in your universe, so I'm not going to debate that. I'm just having flatland, it only has two dimensions, right? Now, if you lived in flatland, your vocabulary would not have any word like tall or short. Why? Because your reality would mean nothing in that reality. They would be absolutely meaningless. You wouldn't say, well, now in flatland, Bill is taller than John. Because in flatland, there is no such thing as tall and short. Well, I would say the same thing about when we use words like I should have, if I did, I should have done this, you ought to have done that, that what we're reflecting is the reality in which we live is such that I, as an individual, really do have the power of choice, not just the power of choice. That's one thing that many might agree to. I would even argue that I'm an agent of change, that I can make a choice and things would go this way. I can make another choice and things would go that way. So it seems to me that if I'm right, that naturalism would lead to a deterministic world, and that is something we can discuss, and you may think, yeah, the guy's a bit off the bubble on this one, but if naturalism does lead to a deterministic world, then I think we have a real problem with a number of things, but especially with this whole matter of our language, in which we talk about possibilities or principle of alternative possibilities. Richard Dawkins, I think, then, is quite right that if we live in a deterministic world, and he thinks we do, for he writes in his book, River Out of Eden, Dawkins says there is no meaning to life, that we are only DNA. And then he says, DNA neither cares nor knows. DNA just is. And we dance to its music. That's a pretty deterministic world. We just dance to its music. In that case, there is no such activity that can be called blameworthy, and there is no such activity that could be praiseworthy. Why? I was just dancing to the music of my DNA, and that's what I'm doing right now. I'm just dancing to the tune of my, to the music of my DNA, which means that everything I've just said is quite meaningless because I had no choice over it. I'm just doing what my DNA tells me to do. Now, I think that that leads to a rather absurd view of the world, to say nothing of the view of me as an individual. But that is what Dawkins thinks that is so. Now, if that's right, then it seems to me a deterministic world has an awful lot to answer for. And then, of course, I'd have to make an argument that we are in a deterministic world if we live in a naturalistic world. If we live in a naturalistic world, we also have to say there is no God. I mean, now that just would be a general conclusion. I mean, it's the logical extension of naturalism. But if naturalism is right and there is no God, a point which I will not major on, but I'm just making another observation and what I would think would be the logical extension of a claim of naturalism, that there would be no God. Matter of fact, the gentleman I debated this past weekend says, yes, I'm a naturalist. If you're a naturalist, you're right, there isn't any God. Well, what do we do with all the people for centuries who have believed in God, the Christian God even? Were they deceived? Were they lying? I mean, we have to answer that question. It's a really interesting question to answer. You can't just pass it by. There's a lot of people who have believed that God exists. But if naturalism is right, there is no God. So if I've said about living either in a chaotic or deterministic world, I've not done a lot with the chaotic world. I'm not just sure how it would look, but somebody might want to appeal to something like quantum physics or something to think that we live in a chaotic world. I'm not sure. It seems to me the more logical way to go with naturalism would be a deterministic world. And what happens then in that state of affairs is that meaning comes totally from particulars. And I see this in our culture. Now I'm beginning to say, well, what might be some of the outcomes of naturalism, a naturalistic worldview? What might be some of the outcomes from that? That is, how might we see it working out in the everyday life of humanity? Well, I would say there's been a switch. There was a time when we talked about virtues, but not anymore. Now we talk about values. Why? Virtues reside in the transcendent. Values can be made up by individuals, they can be relative, and they can be quantified. And that's when you're dealing with only particulars, quantification is a pretty important thing. We find that with a naturalism, how it's worked its way out, is we now think what's really important is what we call efficiency and convenience. That is, efficiency and convenience become the final criteria for what is acceptable in, I would say, not just in the culture in general, but even at the church in large. These ideas of efficiency and convenience are very much anchored in the early teachings, the early thought life of Francis Bacon, who Edward O. Wilson, the great premier biologist, who says that Francis Bacon, not only a very influential man scientifically, though I'm not sure he was much of a scientist, but he influenced science very much, and Edward O. Wilson says he is the architect of the Enlightenment. And what do we find Bacon talking about? He's talking about efficiency and convenience. And if you've ever read his book on the New Atlantis, you will see how that works out. Let me say for the church, evangelicals, I think they've been very much influenced by this, what I would call naturalistic world thinking, even though they claim to think theistically in worldview ways. I think about giving, for example, how that today churches want their people to do a bank draft. Well, why do we do bank drafts for giving? Well, because number one, it's very efficient. And secondly, it's extremely convenient. But what does it do to the individual in his worship of giving? It destroys it. You don't have to think about it. You make one choice. It's kind of, you just make the one choice, like, God, I'm going to serve you. I'm going to go to church on Christmas, and I'll do that every year. And that's about the extent of one's involvement. So I think I can show how this idea of efficiency and convenience flows out of the denial of the universal and leaves us with only particulars, whereby we judge what is really important by the two criteria of efficiency and convenience. I think moral issues have very much become convoluted because of this. We don't really know where we stand in the moral order of things. We don't know how to order our world morally according to some basic transcendental principle. Even though we have people like Mark Hauser and others who are saying that they exist, the fact of the matter is that in public discourse, we hear very little of that. In all of the debates that are going on today now with the presidential elections, but they go on all the time, there are a lot of moral debates going on today. There are debates that deal with end-of-life decisions, beginning-of-life decisions. Notice how we are trying to adjudicate between opinions. We are not adjudicating between differing opinions based upon some kind of moral absolute that men can look at and say, all right, you think this, I think that. Which one seems to fit in best with a moral absolute? And I'm saying it's not just a Christian that would say moral absolutes exist. Atheists say that moral absolutes exist. I just think Christians have a better answer for why they exist. So as I watch public discourse, I notice that many of these discourses go very far awry. As I indicate, sociological issues where virtues are absent from the decision-making. I remember, and I will not use the name of the individual, but there was a particular individual who was running for president a while ago. So don't think it's somebody in the present race, though I think he's in the news. And he didn't make it the first go-round. And so the next presidential election, he decided to run again. And his handlers had told him, you know, the reason that you didn't get elected is, you know, you just don't look like you fit in with the average guy. And so, you know, you're wearing a tie all the time. That's not really good for you. You look too good. So the very first photo op that he had when he kicked off his presidential campaign was we saw him with, you know, jeans and a flannel shirt, and he had a spade and he was digging in the dirt. Probably the first time since 3 years old, but he was digging in the dirt. And I actually heard people say, now we know that so-and-so is one of us. That is, you know, that's a shame that that's the level that we think. I've often thought also, folks, I do not want to be hauled into court. So I'm trying to live my life as cleanly as possible. Because I listen to some of these shows, you know, after they've had one of these major court cases, and they interview the jurors, and I listen to how they made their decision. I'm thinking, I hope I'll never have to go before those folks. I don't think they would know how to determine how to work through the facts of the case or not. And that's part and parcel of this decay that has come from denying the universals, which I would argue is a direct result of naturalism. Think about the Equal Rights Amendment. And I'm not here to debate that issue. I'm just going to say, how did we adjudicate? Can you make a woman equal to a man by simply allowing her to do the same task? No, that's not what makes a woman equal to a man. A woman is equal to a man because of her essence. She is equal to a man. But when we lost that whole notion, then we started trying to make women equal to men by virtue of looking only at the particulars. What can this person do? So if I can do that, then I'm equal to a man. Now that left the guys in a real bad shape, because giving birth is kind of a hard thing for us to do, though there was one recently, but he had help. See, I'm not equal to a woman because I can't give birth. Well, see, you really, if you think about it for a bit, folks, that really becomes quite absurd. But that's exactly where that debate landed, and I think in the process hurt an awful lot of people unnecessarily. And I am certainly, so I know there are ladies in the group, so I want to put my word in for you. I don't think that you should be discriminated against. I think that you should get equal pay for your equal work and all the rest of that. I'm not against that. I think it's all right for you to go out in the work marketplace and have a job and have a career. And can I say anything more to let you know that I'm on your side? So, you know, sometimes you say these things and automatically people put you in a category and say, oh, that old guy, yeah, I bet his wife, you know, you can see her imprint in the plaster on the wall. Well, you might, but that's for other reasons. She's not very obedient. We have to understand that these things go much deeper than how we have tried to explain them in the past. And I think we have not really, in the case of equal rights with women, I think we've done a disservice to the women. To make them think that they've got to go out and drive an 18-wheeler in order to be equal to a man, or they got to have this job or that job. I think they should be free to pursue whatever career they want to, not in order to make them equal, because they already are equal. Women, man and woman, were made by God in the Christian understanding of things, and he made both in the image of God. Man is not superior to woman in the sense of essence, and often not in the sense of intelligence. The beginning of life, and I'll use this one and then we'll close, abortion. If we understood that the idea of essence, then it would put the abortion issue in a totally different light, that what is in the womb, when does it become a person? Does it become a person after the first 7 days, 14 days, first trimester, second trimester, third trimester, or as Peter Singer thinks, maybe 3 years out of the womb before we could, you know, say that somebody is a person, which that's the issue, personhood. So the question is, what denotes personhood? Well, it has nothing to do with developmental issues at all. It has everything to do with essence, I would argue. So, my claim is simply this: denial of universals, which what naturalism leads to, is the denial of the universals. There's nothing that exists above experience. That leads to, I would argue, moral relativism, epistemological relativism, that is, relativism with due to truth. And then it distorts the whole notion of humanity in how we relate and how we have significance and worth as individual human beings. As I've said, those are simply claims that I'm making, and now it's time for you to push back with all your might. And I know that if I get, I cannot answer the question, that Nathan is here, and I will have him answer the question for you. So he's in the back there, so just don't let him out that door, okay? All right, questions. Anybody?
Can we get started with a live question, or I'm free? We have about 7 or 8 that come in via text message, so maybe we should warm it up with text messages.
All right, yes.
Does anybody have a question or not? Before I read one off text messages. Anybody, be the first to go. All right. Well, you can, if you're shy, you can keep texting them in. There were a couple along the same lines here. So I'll read them both. It seems like they're along the same lines. The first one is, do Christians not believe in a sovereign God who controls everything? If so, how is that different than a deterministic worldview of naturalism? And then, related, same type of question, would you put naturalism and deterministic theism on the same plane?
Well, now, Nathan? Let me begin with the first one. I think that there's a great misunderstanding. There are people who think, who hold that God being sovereign means that everything is determined on this earth. There are some. I'm not one of the number, okay? Because I don't see that there's a lot of difference between that and any other form of determinism, except, you know, you can say, well, it's the Heavenly Father that did it. Let me say why I think that's I think it's a problem, but let me explain how we ought to look at, I think, the idea of sovereignty. What we say is sovereignty means God is in control. That I'm putting it down in that basic level. There are two ways that we can think of somebody being in control. One, a person is control. We say the man is in control of his automobile. That means that when he turns right, that he turns the wheel right, that the vehicle goes to the right. And when he pushes the brake pedal, he's been driving the vehicle at a proper rate of speed, and he's able to stop within a reasonable distance, a predictable distance. Now, that is one form of being in control. I would call that very mechanistic view, very deterministic view when applied to God. There is another way, and I think equally legitimate way, of looking at sovereignty, God being in control. It's the same sense that we say the man is in control of his home. In that case, the man lays down the guidelines by which the home is to operate, and everybody is free to operate within those rules. And it's the whoever's in charge of the home is that people stay within the boundaries. I argue for the latter understanding of God's sovereignty. And I can see why the question would ask because you're exactly right. Now, the question is, would that be the same kind of determinism? Well, I don't think we can call it the same kind of determinism, but it is a determinism, and maybe it's one of these cases of differences without distinction. But the end, I would see as being very little different. Whether you get determinism through some mechanistic means of cause and effect, whether biological or otherwise, or if you have this strict determinism, even by a benevolent God. So I'm saying the cause would be different, but I don't see at the end of the day you really have anything much different. So I think we need to go back, revisit our concept, even a biblical concept of sovereignty, where God lays down the rules, what I would call created order, and gives man freedom to make choices within what I call creation order. You can obey God, you can disobey God, you can go left, you can go right, and a whole host of other things.
Just as a follow-up, oh, there we go. You don't have, if he can hear you now. I'll repeat it, so.
Can't you believe in free choice and be a determinist at the same time? So let's say I knew every. So let's say we were related, so I knew you really well, so I could predict what you were going to do.
Yeah.
Now, what if I knew every single fiber of your being in addition to everything else that was going on in your life?
Yeah.
Then eventually I'd get to the point where I could predict accurately exactly what you're going to do. So don't we just use the idea of free choice? Functionally, that works. It's like the, you know, Isaac Newton's laws of physics work, so we can work with them. But ultimately, it's more complicated than that. So the future is going to happen, whatever. But we might as well, you know, the fact that we don't know what we're going to do next doesn't mean that it's not going to happen. If it's not going to happen.
Yeah. Well, no, I've heard the argument. Let me go back then and think about whether or not that's going to work for us. If we're going to talk about God determining, and because he knows everything, he knows all these particulars of me. Okay, but somebody's got to be there knowing, right?
Well, it's kind of, that's the point. Like, we don't know the future, but it doesn't mean that the future isn't going to happen. You see what I mean? So, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I do hear what you're saying, but I think now we've got something different on the table than what we have at the beginning. All right, now we're not talking about determinism per se. That is, we're not talking about my individual thing being determined. You might say the end is determined, but we're not talking about the individual acts that may lead to that.
But does determinism mean that someone is pulling
the
strings, as it were?
Yes, someone or something. Yes, I mean, that's the general notion of determinism. So if you are determined, you could say, I'm determined by my character, right? And so I know that you're a good man, and I now see you. You're walking down the street and you find a wallet. And I can say, I know that you're going to pick the wallet up because you're a good man. Well, the problem with that is now I didn't determine anything. And it is possible that, in fact, on that particular day, you're having a bad day. That particular day, you walk out of character. We say it all the time. Boy, that was out of character. So I don't know that it would work well enough to make that kind of a constructed reality for us.
But if you knew what all the different
There is a difference here between my knowing what you will do and my determining what you will do. So if you're just talking about my knowing, unless you're talking about God, and if it's God we're talking about knowing, it then becomes determinism if all knowledge is causal, because God holds no false knowledge. So that was where that would lead us. But if I'm just simply saying, I know all the possible causes, and therefore I know what you're going to choose, well, that's an issue of, that's an epistemological issue, not an ontological issue.
Yeah, so what are your polar opposites? What does Dawkins do?
Well, I would say, I don't know that Dawkins comes out and knows that he's anything. I mean, he hasn't stated it in that fashion. I don't mean to be disrespectful. He doesn't state it in that fashion. He just simply says, if all we are DNA, then that's, everything we do is just simply dancing to the music of the DNA, and that would be a form of determinism, a causal determinism within the DNA structure of chemical biological reactions.
Couldn't you say, like, DNA just is, and can't you say, God says, I am, like, affirmatively?
Yeah. No, I don't think so, Dawkins just simply says, you know, DNA is. That's not the same thing as saying God is. DNA is not personal. DNA, unless you want to argue for eternality, and that could be an interesting discussion about eternality. No, I don't think we're saying the same thing. Just putting the verb in there doesn't make it the same thing. The attribution is totally different.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. But good. They're questions, and we think through those things. But I'm not convinced that we can make a distinction, and say, well, that probably you can have determinism and you can have free will at the same time.
So along the taking a different way, a couple questions coming in about morality and. Where do they come from? So two questions. How would you respond to the claim that God is not needed to have a standard of good and morality can be socially constructed? And then kind of pushing that ball further, couldn't you say that universal moral rules are an evolutionary advantage?
Well, that is surely, that's what some people have been saying, but I see now even atheists backing away from that because Mark Hauser, who says that even if you go across all the different cultural variations, he says there's to him, the only explanation is that there are, you've got to have moral absolutes that are innate in the thing. He said there's no other explanation for what we are seeing. And if you probably know, people like Sam Harris is getting a degree in neuroscience. A lot of this is being predicated upon neuroscience, as well as a lot of studies that are being done. So if we say that this idea that's morally developed because it gives us a strategic advantage.
It doesn't say, it just says, it makes the argument that they could be of an advantage if they're evolving. So yeah. I guess along the lines, newer is better. It's more developed. We have a keener sense of good and bad because we've developed. Couldn't that be an argument for why that is a better system of morality?
Yes, but then we got to figure out, well, why is it a better system? I mean, who determines what is going to be better? Somebody like Adolf Hitler thought that the best thing for humanity was to annihilate 6 million plus. So you've still left yourself without any kind of a standard by which to claim this is better or that's better. And if you're only making it on pragmatic grounds, then you see, I think the thing goes quite haywire, because I could argue all sorts of things on pragmatic grounds.
All right. Oh, we got hands going up. I'm going to go here, and then I'm gonna work my way up to the front. So. Take that.
Evolution works by the mechanism of survival of the fittest, so couldn't we just say that morals are a fit way to go on? That if I'm living in a society and my society happens to evolve a sense of we shouldn't kill each other, my society is going to live better than the society that evolved we should kill each other, and so we'll reproduce our genes and go on.
Well, I think, you know, right. I think that's the argument, you know, that has been made, that they evolve. But I'm still wondering, if it's strictly on pragmatic grounds, what is best for me? I guess you would agree then we have sort of a relativistic morality at that point?
I think theoretically, yes, practically, no.
And how would that be different?
Practicality, like things like we shouldn't murder each other, or like don't hurt, you know, your close relatives, is an evolutionary advantage because your genes that are related, because your society around you shares genes with you. Your genes. Mm-hmm. So, from a practical standpoint, anything that preserves your genes is an evolutionary advantage. So, if we develop morals and call that good, practically speaking, we're all going to come up with the same morals, even if they're not created by some non-naturalistic universal standard.
Okay. And the idea of morals, just the concept of morals, good and bad, where did that come from? But we have people who don't think that way, who think it's really better for me to kill you.
I mean,
so is that... Well, I just hope it doesn't work that way in my neighborhood. That's all. I think you're left with the question of where the concept of morality itself comes from. Where do words like good and bad and just and unjust, they have to exist prior to, not after. We don't just do something and say that is just. Those words are with us at the beginning. And that would be an argument, for example, that, like I say, Walter Sennett Armstrong makes a very strong case for that, as did Mark Hauser, that they are just innate.
Hopefully my question ties along. Mine has to do with evolution as well.
Yes.
In regards to form and essence, I think Plato kind of makes or discusses the fact that he even discusses a hammer, saying the essence or purpose of a hammer is to hammer nails.
Yes.
You could take a saw and try to do it, but doing so doesn't make the saw a hammer.
Right.
So if there is a correlation or relationship between purpose and essence, or purpose essence in form, if the purpose of something changes or evolves, are you also evolving its essence? Or have you done any, come across any studying or formed an opinion on that.
That's good. What I would say is the illustration contaminates the discussion because I don't think that a hammer has an essence. I'm only talking about living things. So now I didn't catch the first. Were you quoting Aristotle or Plato?
I don't remember.
Okay. I mean, you don't remember what you just said, or you don't remember which one?
No, I don't remember which one I was reading. But despite the analogy or the illustration, as you put it, my inquiry, I think, is still relevant, which is, if the purpose of a person or an entity changes or evolves, does that mean that the essence of the entity evolves as well? Or do you have an opinion on that, or have you read it or studied it?
Yeah. I would say, you know, that it's Aristotle who thinks, you know, that that's what it is. It's the end, it's the purpose, the teleos, and there may be some truth to that. I'm not sure that we can argue backwards. But if something becomes something different, then yes, the essence would have had to change. And I think that's what Richard Dawkins is complaining about, because he said as long as that notion of essence was there, you couldn't get the change of one thing being something totally different. So yes, if that could happen, and there are people who think it can. I mean, I'm not picking on any religion or anything, but the transubstantiation. There are people who believe that the bread at the Eucharist actually becomes the body of Christ. That would be a transubstantiation. that's not necessarily a very universally thought, only within the religious realm like that. But I don't think anybody would believe it, you know, outside. There is something that magical, because Christianity allows for the miracle, so that becomes a miracle. So it's something above what would normally happen. But I think you're right. Let's just not say the end or the purpose, but if there is a change from one to another, it's what these call natural kinds, as you're looking back, as these things were discussed a number of years ago. If a species moves from one natural kind to another natural kind, it could only happen if the essence changed, as I would see it. Yeah. Now, I was good to the women, so I just want you to be good to me, okay?
So this isn't about women. So I guess I was imagining when you were speaking about atheists who believe in absolute morality.
Yes.
That, in fact, people who don't believe in absolute categories in the way that religious philosophers traditionally do would say that ultimately that they don't believe in moral absolutes in the same way that a Christian, for instance, might believe in a moral absolute, that we're sort of constrained by the idea of wanting to say, I have an absolute morality, because it saves us from saying my morality is totally arbitrary, because it's unacceptable to us to say that our morality is arbitrary. And I guess, you know, I was wondering what you think about that, for someone to say, yes, actually my morality does come from disparate parts. It doesn't come from a central source. It is cobbled together by society or by something else, and I don't know where it comes from. But I'm going to call it absolute for the sake of something that's, you know, inborn in me that wants to call it absolute. Does that make sense to say that it's a sort of a convenient way of putting things rather than what people actually believe? Does that make sense?
Well, I think I have it. So if I don't get to what you're saying, please correct me. You're saying that we don't really have, there aren't really absolute morals, but we like to affirm them by what we believe, but we don't necessarily believe them because those things actually exist.
I was sort of asking what you think of the idea that you were arguing that, in fact, all people believe in absolute morality. And I guess I was sort of affirming that, in fact, some people do not believe in absolute morality, even though they would say that they do.
Yeah.
And how you would just respond to that.
Yeah, I think now we've just changed it a little bit, okay? But that's fine. There's a difference. I'm not saying that my morality is absolute. what we are arguing, and even the atheists argue, that there are what we call universal moral concepts. That's different from saying that my morality is absolute. Because I don't think I don't really care for the notion of the absolute when I talk about, you know, my morality is absolute. No, what I'm saying is that there is morality, but go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm not sure about the distinction. Surely if there were a moral absolute, it could be known by a person. In order for it to be meaningful.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying it can't be known, and I'm not saying that they don't exist. I'm only talking about when I say that my morals are absolute, I don't know that my morals are absolute. What I'm saying is my idea of morality is grounded in some absolute, just like everybody else's is. But it doesn't mean that a particular act is a result of an absolute.
So you're saying you don't really believe that anyone does not aim to ground their morality in an absolute or hope that their actions are absolutely moral?
Well, once again, you've used two different concepts. Okay. I think, yes, everybody, whether they know it or not, ground their idea of morality in the absolute. Okay? But that doesn't mean that as I say, oh, I believe this is wrong, that is absolutely wrong. Some people say that it is absolutely wrong, morally wrong, for a woman to wear slacks. And they say it's absolute. And I say, well, no, it's not. That's not absolute. So what we're arguing, and I'm not sure I've argued very well, but I'm saying arguing is that there's, and I'm using now the other atheists who are also saying the same thing. They're not trying to say that everybody is arguing for the same kind of morality. They're all saying we all have this idea of morality and that there are general principles, what they call principles of morality, and that those general universal principles of morality are fleshed out differently in every culture. But a person may not even realize or may not even want to make an affirmation that they're grounded in some universal, some absolute, but simply because they don't say that doesn't mean that that's not the ontological reality.
Any other questions? I've got some more text messages I can read as I walk back. Any other questions?
All right.
As you're working back there, the discussion of morality is really one of these that's difficult to grasp, I think. For so long time, Christians were saying that their morality was absolute. And I'm not arguing that. I'm arguing that there are absolute moral principles by which all humanity govern their behavior so that human behavior, no matter where you go, is always critiqued in moral categories everywhere. And it may not always be identical. In some place, it may be it's moral to have 16 wives. In other, it may be only to have one wife. But it's still moral behavior, and it's judged as moral behavior. The argument is that moral behavior would not be in our vocabulary unless it was universal. It's the only explanation for it. For it to be universal, that is the moral vocabulary to be universal.
Speaking of universal and things that are transcendent, if non-determinism doesn't arrive naturally, why would God create laws of nature just to break them with regularity?
Well, I would debate, I'm assuming that person is talking about miracles. I would argue that God does not break the law, break the laws when a miracle. Now, the whole concept of law of nature starts out with somebody like an Isaac Newton, and in those days, law and the L and nature were lowercase. Eventually, they would be uppercase to indicate that they had a status of their own. If there are laws of nature, and I'll grant that there are, in this sense, that we have been able to catalog and categorize the function and the orderliness of the universe in which we live, whereby we're able to make predictions, and quite accurately so, because there's a regularity and there is a stability to the ordering of the universe. A miracle, which I'm assuming is what's being referred to here, a miracle does not break the law of nature. That would not make any sense. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that because you asked the question. Now I think you're senseless. But I didn't mean that. What we would argue is this, that God, when there is a change, a miracle, I'm assuming that's what we're talking about, when there's a miracle that takes place, all we are saying is that there's a power that transcends the power that has been spoken, that has been cataloged for us, and let's just say the law of gravity or the law of specific gravity. We have a case in the Old Testament where we have an axe head that floats to the top. Apparently, the specific gravity of that piece of iron changed. I mean, there may be other explanations. But all we're talking about is that there is a force greater than the regularity of the universe, and it only happens in that one particular place. I can do the very same thing. I can throw a ball up in the air, and I can put my hand out, and I can keep it from hitting the floor, going to its natural end. That doesn't mean that the law of nature has been broken. I actually suspended by just inserting a power that was greater than the power of gravity. So it's only a matter of what we would say when a miracle happens, that God super imposes, brings a transcendent power upon that piece of reality. But we can't say the law is broken. If the law was broken, then mercy, the whole thing would be a mess. Because if it's specific gravity of iron and that particular law is broken, then all over the world, that sort of it would have terrible ramifications. So I don't think we can argue that the law was broken.
Any follow-up questions on miracles or thing like that? Yes. Can we speak into this to the people in back community college?
Sure. So when you're learning physics and engineering and all of the different sorts of sciences,
yes,
one thing you learn is that every single thing that we consider a law of science or nature hasn't been determined by anything other than empiricism. And so all of our relationships in terms of physics and such are results of experimental processes.
Yes.
And so to say that you're not, breaking the laws of nature is to imply that we actually know the laws, and we really don't. So wouldn't it be more accurate to say that in some ways miracles could be God working within the laws in a way that we don't understand and we possibly can't understand?
I think that's reasonable. I don't know enough about science to make the case for that, but you maybe could. I think that's a possibility. I wouldn't rule it out.
Okay, I think it's a follow-up to the lady on my left. So okay. Let's say I'm an atheist and I don't believe in morals. What do you say to me? What do you say to try and sway my point of view to yours? Or do you just say?
I think if you don't believe in morals, I would say this is going to be awful. I'm going to say you're an amoral person, right?
An amoral person, someone without morals.
Right, is that what I would call you?
Yeah, you mean like as in a bad person or just someone without morals?
Well, no. Just because you don't believe in morals doesn't say that you don't live by them.
Yeah, so what do you say to that person to try and sway their view towards yours?
I'm not sure I know what I could say to you. I mean, yeah. In other words, because if you don't believe in miracles, morals, you can believe anything. You can only know what is true. So if that's your belief, I would, I might ask you, well, let's look at reality.
Yeah, but when if I assert a belief, I'm appealing to the truth. So I'm saying I don't believe there are morals because I believe it is true that there aren't morals. So I'm giving you the possibility that there actually isn't morals. There are no morals.
But, okay.
So, Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose anybody could argue that. It would seem to fit, be very difficult to fit into the ontological structure of the world in which we live. You would be going against the grain. But I'm saying you can believe that because you can believe anything.
Yeah.
You can believe the moon is made of cheese.
But I'm going against the grain of what people believe, but I'm not necessarily going against the grain of the entire universe, because your argument as to why there has to be morals is because everybody believes in morals, as far as I understand.
Mm-mm.
So, or the majority, that's... So what's your argument as to why there has to be morals?
That would be an argument backwards.
Right.
No, I'm not arguing there must be morals. I'm just arguing that there are. That the ontological reality in which we live, there are morals, that's all.
Okay.
So. I'm not arguing that they have to be, I'm just saying there are. Okay. And so if they're there, I want to know, well, why are they there? Because I'm one of these causal individuals, I'd like to know if I see something here, well, I would like to know where'd it come from.
Yeah.
So, no, I'm not arguing we must have morals, I'm only arguing that we have them.
Okay, so I guess going back to the whole evolution style thing, so I would see morals as, if I was doing something that other people construed as being good, I would just say, well, I was just doing it because it's good for social cohesion, because at the end of the day, I wanna live, and that's just how I am. Like, that's how animals are, because you could say that, you know, animals can act in such a way as to have, almost have morals, because they want to survive and it's good for their survival, for example. So.
Yeah.
Am I not quite steadfast in that view then? You know, how do you, with logic, how do you sway me away from that?
Well, I don't think I can.
Okay.
I know that the fox, when he eats the rabbit, thinks it's a pretty good thing. I don't think the rabbit's too happy with that encounter. I think that we can raise those kind of questions, you know, like, well, I just don't want to believe it, or I believe that the morals come from another way, then I would say, here's what we do. One believes that morals come from evolutionary some form, okay? In that case, we're not denying that morals exist. We're not even denying how to define a moral. We're defining where does the moral come from. It has to come from somewhere. So then we say, well, you've got God as a possibility, you've got evolution as a possibility, and then it doesn't become a question of religion or anything, it becomes a matter of reality. It's an ontological question. Which of these two systems seems to answer the largest amount of the data that we have in a consistent way? And that's what I would do. I would say, okay, we bring our ideas to the table, and you make your best case, I'll make my best case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I see that if I don't believe in God, I don't see that I need to look at things in a moralistic way. I probably would need to acknowledge that I want certain things in my life. So I want to survive, I want to eat rabbits. I can see that, you know, if there's overall social cohesion, then it's better for everyone. But I just think when you say that you believe there is morals, I just think
Well, Nietzsche would agree
with you. So, Dr. Little, answer that one. Then we have two more questions in about 10 minutes.
Nietzsche would agree with you, right? Yeah. Well, don't bother if you haven't. I wouldn't waste my time. Go ahead.
So, two more questions. Can't non-determinism and free will come from the probabilities inherent in quantum mechanics?
I would have to tell you that that may be possible. I have no background in quantum mechanics, and I should not try to answer that question.
Okay.
I know something about indeterminism and all the rest of it, but...
We have a quantum physicist here,
okay.
So she's going to help us out.
There you go.
He goes, speaks with people
in mind. I hope this is not the same as my previous question, but if people deny essences, what do you say to them? If someone says
things do not, in fact, happen to have an essence, but human beings categorically do believe in things having categories.
Yeah.
And therefore, I just ascribe categories to people, like believing in things categorically. I guess, what's your response to that, to say that categories are a result of a particular human nature as a result of evolution, as some people do, in fact, argue?
Yeah, I would say that categories that you have are simply the reflection of the essence, whether you accept it or not. We do make those categories. We talk about the category of human beings, for example. Now, what we're talking about is not can you do that or why you do that. Mine is a little further back and say, well, why is it that we have these, why do we recognize that these group of beings over here have these similarities? And I would say, well, then that's due to the essence. The essence is an explanatory thing. It doesn't tell me why you may categorize things a certain way.
But if we say there is no such thing as essence, what's the result?
Well, I think the result is that you exactly what Richard Dawkins says: if there are no essences, you're only left with particulars. And if you're only left with particulars, you and I are what we are by virtue of some naturalistic explanation. And that is some chemical, biological reaction, causal relationship. Now, I think that one can explain it that way. The question is that the best explanation? And I would argue I don't think it is the best explanation. Now, if I'm a Christian, which I am, I think that we have a hard time denying essences, particularly when we come to the incarnation of Christ. What makes Christ Christ? Christ is the Son of God, not by some developmental issue, but he has the nature of God within. That's an essence. So if we deny essences, I'm not sure how we're going to deal with the whole issue, the ontological issue of Christ as the Son of God and Son of Man.
No, I don't think you can be a Christian if you deny essences.
Pardon?
I don't think you can be a Christian if you deny essences.
Oh, okay. All right.
I had a question. So unless I wrote it down wrong, your definition of naturalism was a denial of anything that transcends experience. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So most constructions of Christianity that I've encountered fundamentally depend on an experience of God through personal salvation. So how do you reconcile that?
Oh, well, that's...
Is it just a difference about the physical and the non-physical, and how do you draw those category distinctions?
Okay, yes. I'm not saying that we don't have experience, okay? In your case of, you know, Christians claim to have an experience of God, all right? Well, we're not using the word experience in the same way. We've equivocated on the word experience at that point. When we say nothing above experience, I was using the language of Richard Weaver. What we could say is there's nothing that transcends nature, if that would help you. Richard Weaver is the one who says there's nothing that transcends, and I use that language when I debate in different places, but we're just saying in that way, nothing, that everything that is only nature. There's nothing above nature, and we use experience in that way.
So this distinction there is physical?
You mean when I use the word experience?
When you use the word nature or experience?
Yes.
Okay, so you're talking about physical versus
matter.
Non.
Yes, matter. Matter. Yes, okay.
So the last text question that came in was, can you provide an argument for essentialism? And help me understand define essentialism for us. I think that'd be helpful for me.
We don't have 3 hours.
But you do have 3 minutes.
I have 3 minutes, okay. Essentialism is simply that we are what we are by virtue of our essence. Starts with something like a Plato. Here's where the problem was, okay? From philosophically, here's the problem. You have somebody like Parmenides. Parmenides says all reality is one. And then you have Heraclitus comes along and says, no, I've looked at reality and reality is changing. Heraclitus is the one who said you never can step into the same river twice. So when I look at the world empirically, it does look to me like it's changing. But if everything is changing, we've got another problem, which I can't get into now, but let's just take that as it surfaced in philosophy. So Plato comes along and said, this is how we can do it. Whether he's right or not, this is how we can do it. There's the form that's up there, whatever he meant by that, okay? Now, that never changes. So then that way, he shows reality has an unchanging aspect to it, and there he satisfies what Parmenides was asking for. But then he says, there is the thing down here, that is the material thing, and that the form, the real that's up there, is in the thing somehow that makes it what it is. But the thing here, what Plato called the shadow, that is what we see that changes. So the way that the early philosophers, and then it went right into Christianity by people like Augustine and others, where they said, yes, that makes sense. There's something that's unchanging about reality. But there's also something that's changing about reality. So I don't change. I mean, my hair's receded. A man in the restaurant told me today that my hair's receding. I'm changing. But that is not my essence. If when I get old and decrepit, I'm still a human being. That can't change. You can cut off my hair. You can cut off my arms. Whatever you want to do, I will look different to you physically, but essentially, substantively, I'm the same thing. Aristotle talked about it being the difference between a substantive and an accidental. Substantive doesn't change. Dogs are dogs, whether you cut they got big ears, little ears, long noses, short noses. Dogs are dogs because they have the essence of dogness. I am a human being. I'm a human being because I have the essence of humanness. And all of the particulars about this body can change, and they do, but that doesn't change the essence of who I am. So if I'm in a coma, if I'm an old person, if I'm at the end of my life, and I'm getting there quickly, if I'm at the end of my life, I'm still a human being at the end of my life as I was at the moment of conception. So that's what essentialism does for us. It speaks about the essence of things. And as I've said, it seems to me that, as a Christian at least, the whole notion of essence is really important, particularly when you talk about the incarnation of Christ. Because the only thing that makes Christ the Son of God is that he has the essence of God. He says he's God, and he's also man. So what made him a man? He had the essence of humanity. He was the last Adam. He is truly Christ. What makes him God is not his developmental, not that he wore a certain robe. What makes him Christ, the Son of God, is that he has the essence of God. And that's why I think, as a Christians at least, it gets difficult to deny the notion of an essence.
All right, Dr. Little, work a little overtime. So one last question.
Okay.
This last question. Is there room for the divine in a chaotic naturalism? It seems that if a deterministic world is absurd, a chaotic one is a more plausible naturalism.
That person who's raised the question, I'd really like to think through that with you. I have not given a lot of thought about how a chaotic would work. It just seems to me that a chaotic universe kind of goes against the way we live. That is, the ontological dimensions of the ordering of our universe. We make plans. We struggle to make a decision. But if I lived in a chaotic universe, I wouldn't have to struggle to make a decision. I wouldn't have a clue what's going to come next. Therefore, I wouldn't bother to put any money in a retirement. It just seems to me that a totally chaotic world. Now, it doesn't seem quite reasonable to me, just by virtue of the way I live and how I understand reality. I just think there's a difference in this, and make the distinction between what I would argue is that while not everything in this world has a purpose, everything in this world has a reason. So I think we can argue for a reasonableness to our universe, an orderliness to our universe. If we live in a chaotic universe, folks, I don't know how we could possibly put a man on the moon. I don't know how we could possibly do all we have done for science. I think science is the strongest argument against a chaotic universe. I don't see how we could do science in a chaotic universe. But anyway, thank you very much. Your questions have been good. You've been most charitable in listening to less than what you wanted to hear. You think he didn't really answer my question, and that was probably by design. I didn't know how to answer that question. But you've been very charitable, very kind, and I greatly appreciate an opportunity. And I love these kind of interactions. They make me think. I hope they make you think.
Thank you, Dr. Little. We're glad that you guys took the opportunity to come out here on a Friday night, of all things, to do, just to think through these things. The scriptures teach us that we should love the Lord our God with all our heart, with all our minds, with all our soul, with all our strength. And so at Restoration Church, we bring folks like Dr. Little up and try to have our folks think deeply with their minds. I think it's a bit of a, Christians have not historically done a really good job thinking with their minds, and they use language like, you know, well, I just have a faith like a child, and so they don't sort of use it as an excuse to use their brains. And so we as Christians, and especially at Restoration Church, while we are not nearly as intelligent as Dr. Little, we do operate with the same Spirit of God within us and the same Bible, which we hold out and try to teach deeply and profoundly, that we would not insult you by calling you to not use your brain. And so we try to do that. And so on Sunday night at 5 o'clock, we'll be here, and we will be completing the book of Acts. So it'll be the last few verses of Acts. So we would love for you to come and join us. Thank you again for coming out. I'm sure Dr. Little will make himself available for a few minutes more before he has to leave us. But once again, glad you came. And if I didn't have a chance to meet you, thanks again for coming, and have a good night.